This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me the award-winning playwright Joan Holden, who worked for 3 decades with the San Francisco Mime Troupe and is now touring with her play of Barbara Ehrenreich's best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. Joan Holden, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's a pleasure and an honor.
Oh, come now. Tell me what drew you to Nickel and Dimed. How'd you get involved in doing this play?
I got a phone call, actually. I'd read about Barbara's book. I'd read reviews of it, and I thought, what a great idea. I wish I'd thought of it. I was actually jealous. So when I got a phone call in the fall of 2001, actually, I guess it must have been August, because it was shortly before 9/11, I remember this, saying from the Intiman Theater in Seattle, the dramaturg, that's the person who deals with playwrights, calls and asks, would I be interested in adapting Nickel and Dimed for the stage? I said, yes, yes, yes. And then I ran out and bought the book really fast. And then I was a little worried about what I was getting myself into, because it's not a book that naturally adapts itself to a play. When you think of adapting a book for the stage, you think of a novel. You think of Nicholas Nickleby. You think of something that has scenes and characters already developed and a protagonist. This and Barbara's book, which we should talk about, for those who, if there's anyone out there who hasn't read it, they should immediately go out and buy it too. Barbara Ehrenreich in the late 90s as a mid-50-ish famous writer decided to find out what it's really like to live on low-wage jobs.
Not that famous, because no one she applied to work for had ever heard of her, though.
Although she expected them to. That was the first shock of many she was to encounter. Here's a very self-confident, very able, very smart person who also comes from a working-class background, although her father rose in life. So she thought she was very, very well-prepared for this journey, and that she wouldn't be a wimp like most middle-class writers would be. And she had many rude shocks in store, which did make it naturally good for a play. What's great about it for a play is the same thing that's great about it for the book. For a middle-class audience, she is a guide they can identify with to a world that they don't really want to enter.
But Joan Holden, can I just interrupt there a second? Because that is actually one of the criticisms of the book. I haven't seen the play, but one of the criticisms of the book is that, oh, there's Barbara Ehrenreich, you know, this great prize-winning writer who's slumming it, and that the only way that middle-class people can understand the lives of working-class people is not through the experiences of actual living and breathing working-class people, but through a middle-class person?
Better than nothing. No. People who work, I mean, working class, that's a really wide range, right? And in the job she's talking about, hotel chambermaid, maid in a maid service, waitress in a chain restaurant, Walmart associate, these are the kind of jobs, as she found, that you need two of to survive. That was one of the big lessons. Who that's working two jobs and struggling to pay the bills has time to write the book? That's all. I think Barbara was very humble about it and constantly aware of this paradox, actually, and constantly aware, painfully aware of the fact that she's lying to the people who were being kind to her, to her fellow workers. You know, there's a kind of guilt in being a writer and being a journalist. I've felt it myself. When you go out and get somebody's story, you aren't always open about what you're going to do with it. And she couldn't be, you know. So there comes a moment. She took 3 trips, one to Florida, one to Maine, one to Minneapolis. And at the end of each, she basically has to tell her fellow workers that she's not who she pretended to be. And there's a kind of betrayal there.
There's that famous New Yorker essay that says all journalists are liars and deceivers.
Did you see In Cold Blood?
I haven't seen the movie.
But that's about that. And it made me very uncomfortable. because I've been that person. Get deep into somebody's life because you want to tell their story. It's not that it's not because you want to make $1 million on their story. It's because you think their story is important and has to be told. Still, to get into it, you get very intimately, deeply involved with somebody, and they talk to you. You become their friend, and then you disappear from their life in order to write the story or do whatever it is that you're going to do with it. I've had that kind of experience writing plays, formed very intense relationships with people in the worlds that I was writing about.
As I recall the book, when she comes clean finally with some of the people she's working with, some are angry and feeling betrayed. But my sense of it was most people were just incredulous. Why in the world would you do this?
Yeah, why would you do this? I had to hype it a little bit to make a play out of it. But there is all, you know, one of the episodes ends. The maid that in the maid service stops speaking to her. You know, very painful things. The waitress is surprised. And doesn't really. But there's a bad moment where, oh, you're not who you said you were. You were holding out.
You play on this. You utilize this conflict situation.
I definitely do. Yeah, you have to hype everything to make it play out of it. A book has 50 incidents, and in a play you can get maybe 10 of them, and you have to make those 10 have all the power, the accumulated power of the 50. So you have to pack more into you have to make mountains out of molehills.
And what's the reaction from Barbara Ehrenreich to this?
Well, she's very polite about it, but I can sum it up this way. She says I fictionalized the book. I say I didn't fictionalize it. I just dramatized it. I didn't pump it more than it needed to be pumped to be stage worthy. You know, I felt very, but it did need some pumping, as any book would.
And she's the central character.
Yes, and that was the difficulty, because she's not the central character in the book. There is no central character in the book. There's an observer. But a play needs a protagonist. A play needs somebody that you're following through. And the challenge here, because there's a great cast of characters that she introduces us to. I've taken the most vivid characters in the book. And only in one case did I combine them, did I make a composite character.
And what is the arc of the main character, Barbara Ehrenreich, here? Do you use her whole name, or do you just use
Barbara? No, Barbara.
Just Barbara.
I just say my name. She says my name's Barbara, and I also didn't find enough in the book about Barbara. I found some glimpses and hints that I wanted to follow up on, and
maybe this is why she wasn't.
No, we're friends. She understood. It's just that it's a strange experience for her to watch somebody pretending to be herself on the stage, and her kids say it's very weird to watch somebody pretending to be your mother. And say, you know, for her, I've had this, ironically, had the experience subsequently. Somebody put me in a play, they didn't fictionalize me exactly. They just exaggerated me.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm host Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Joan Holden, who is an award-winning playwright, and her latest play is an adaptation of Barbara Ehrenreich's best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. So what happens to Barb? Or Barbara?
Barb in the play. Barbara, who becomes Barb. Barb is the person she's reduced to in the end, when she's really barely surviving and barely keeping her sanity and can't find a place to live in Minneapolis. Barbara in the play, let's say the dramatized Barbara, is a successful author, a successful person, very self-confident, who decides to make this journey. Actually, she gets trapped into it by an editor, and that's the way it really happened.
Oh, those editors, they can do anything.
who decides to take this journey, find out what it's like on the other side of the divide, and who's confident that she's better qualified for it than most people because of her working-class family background. And she also is doing it as a kind of tribute to her ancestors. This is very clear in the book. She wants to be worthy of them. And she knows it's going to be hard. She knows it's going to be no fun a lot of times. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be physically exhausting. But she never doubts in the beginning that she can do it.
And you ever giving a soliloquy about this at the beginning?
Yes. You know, she says she breaks through the fourth wall. She talks directly to the audience. Can a reasonably intelligent woman in middle life go to a strange place, find a place to live and an entry level job and survive and make it and save enough to make the next month's rent? And the answer, to her great surprise, is no, she can't. She'd have to have two jobs.
Do you think she was surprised, or do you think
she came with
that expectation and just wanted
surprised.
To describe it?
She knew the statistics, but she was surprised. She was surprised about rents. She was surprised how hard it was to make ends meet. She was surprised at the humiliations she endured.
Well, tell me what some of those humiliations were and some that you incorporate into the play. Are there any that stick in your mind as
being yelled at by a restaurant manager, being made to scrub floors on her hands and knees by a lady, by a rich lady in Maine, enduring, she wasn't surprised. She knew about job questionnaires, but she really wasn't ready for the kind of questions that they ask, which turn out to be, she says, they're just a way of, it's not that they don't get information from these questionnaires. Do you tend to be depressed, moody, irritable? If a fellow worker steals on the job, would you report them, or do you consider that they need the money? These kind of dumb questions that you can immediately answer, and you know exactly what they want. She says this isn't designed to give them information. This is designed to tell you who's boss.
It's about power.
And the position of being powerless is unpleasant, and she endured this unpleasantness. But what she finds in the play is not something she avows in the book. And she and I could probably have an interesting discussion about whether I pegged her correctly or not. That what Barbara learns really, I'm saying this is the fictional Barbara. This is the play Barbara, my character. Okay, this is not Barbara Ehrenreich. But the Barbara in the play discovers through her own reactions that she's actually a member of the middle class and not a member of the working class. And this is a humbling experience for her.
Is there an event that makes her realize that, or how does she react?
The big culminating event, there are a couple. There are three, each time she leaves in the play. But in Florida, in a really bad day, on a really, what you call in the restaurant business, being slammed. This restaurant is slammed. It's a huge rush. Your tour bus is there. Every table is full. All the orders are going crazy. She melts down. She walks off the job. And she leaves her fellow shift workers in the lurch, especially someone who has helped her, and she feels terrible. That's a big, big failure. So it then becomes very important for her to prove that she can do it, that she can survive, and she's going to be smarter next time. Actually, she melts down on the first day that she tries working two jobs, and she discovers, okay, I'm 55 years old. I can't work two physically demanding jobs in one day. I have to work 7 days a week instead. I have to have a weekend job. But if my grandmother could do it, so can I. God damn it, I'm going to do it. In Maine, where she works as a maid, the mistake she made is to be overzealous on workers' behalf, on her fellow workers' behalf. When she says, when somebody gets hurt on the job, Holly falls down the stairs and breaks her leg and doesn't want to go to the emergency room, Barbara threatens to calls the boss on the telephone, the franchise owner, the maid service, and says, you get this girl to a hospital or we're all going out on strike.
But her fellow workers
suddenly
might not elect it.
Resounding silence. Yeah. And she realizes that she's crossed the line. She hasn't thought for even a minute about what this would mean to them, about what losing their jobs would mean to them, about how they can't afford to do this. This is a very terrible lesson. So that's another, the middle class activist on behalf of the worker. may not understand all the reality of the worker's life. That's very humiliating for her.
They've got much more freedom than the person who's depending on that paycheck.
Has a lot more freedom, and she has to realize that about herself. And the last time is in Walmart when she can't find. She's done this three times now. She's living in a seedy, horrible motel, and she can't. There's no place that she can afford to rent, not a studio apartment that she can afford to rent. And she's not getting enough sleep, and she's hanging up clothes all day at Walmart, going nuts. And when and living on her credit card, which is a terrible thing, because she's failing to do the thing she started out to do. And when a fellow worker offers her a couch to stay on, offers her to solve her problem by letting her sleep in her living room with her abusive husband and her pack of hound dogs, Barbara says, no, I can't. Feels, I can't. An offer that anyone who is really in the situation would jump at.
So she ultimately can't do it, but millions of Americans do it.
Exactly, and she has to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. She can't do it because she doesn't have to. Obviously, if she had to, she could, you know. But so she finds out those are each of those reactions is the reaction of somebody who doesn't have to live the life. Mm-hmm. And that's where she finds out her place in the world. Still, though, I want to say in Barbara's defense, nobody else is telling this. You know, she told the story. David Shipler also wrote a book called The Working Poor, where he interviewed lots and lots of people and tells their story. But it's not the same as being on the job floor where Barbara is.
I'm speaking with Joan Holden. She is the playwright adapting Barbara Ehrenreich's best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. What's the reaction you get from audiences?
Depends on the audiences. There's the reaction you talked about. She's slumming. Doesn't everybody know this from people who work those jobs or whose parents work those jobs? And all you can say to that is, no, everybody doesn't know this, but everybody should. So cut Barbara some slack. She's telling this story. To people who say, oh, thank you for telling us this. It's so important to me to know this. I will never look through the maid or the busboy again. I see these people differently, and I've heard this after the fact. Great response from at a cafe where it was done near a theater in Mountain View, California, which is a very affluent community, big theater.
High-tech area.
Yeah, high-tech land. Somebody interviewed the baristas in the cafe and asked if they'd seen the play. They said no, but since it was playing, their tips had gone up. You know,
well, that's good.
Radio host in L.A. said he went home. Lots of people. I've raised my house cleaner's wages. I didn't even ask. I just went and raised their wages. I mean, so Barbara's instinct that the middle class doesn't see the class who serves them and subsidizes their life is absolutely true. On the other hand, there's a certain defensive reaction, which we got a lot, and which I incorporated into a later version of the play. In both in Seattle and in Los Angeles, where it played at the Mark Taper Forum, in Seattle at the Intiman Theater, these are big regional subscription theaters with affluent audiences. At talkbacks, there was always someone, interestingly, it was usually a man, who was angry because Barbara seemed to be saying that he hadn't earned his place in life all by himself. That's one of the things that she says. You can't tell me that my life was subsidized. I started with nothing. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. If I can do it, so can everybody else. So can anybody else. These people are in these jobs because they don't get it together, because they're lazy, because they're not smart enough, et cetera, et cetera. And it was very clear that this was a personal challenge.
How do other people in that talkback respond when that man says that?
Well, it's usually the person being talked at back at me who has to.
Oh, that's you. You're getting the talk back.
Who has to respond.
And how do you deal with that?
I think I actually use Barbara's point, which is that everybody, There are exceptional individuals. In fact, there must be at least one behind the story of every family that's made it to the middle class, must be standing on the shoulders of that exceptional ancestor, that person possessed of three times the usual amount of ability and energy who hauled that family out of the mud, and it's never needed to be in the mud since. But surely we can't, she's saying that's the exception. A third of the country, we need these jobs done. A third of the country is going to be doing these jobs. Surely you can't say that these people are all failures. They're
No, you said you incorporated that in later versions
yes,
of the play. How'd you do
that?
In
the character of, well, this was one of the hints in the book, is that Barbara's significant other wasn't happy with what she was doing. And I was going to say that Trinity Repertory Theater in Providence, which was the third place to do the play, paid for me to go to Virginia, to Charlottesville, and spend a weekend with Barbara. We spent a weekend hanging out, and I actually did some of this on the phone. I called her up and followed up these hints about her family and her personal relationship. And it turned out that this relationship had broken up over the course of this project. So I had to put that boyfriend in the play, and I gave him all those arguments. It's interesting. And since those arguments are in the play, we stopped getting them at the talkbacks. Hmm.
Did the boyfriend ever get back to you?
No, haven't heard from him. Don't know if he's seen the play.
Now, I haven't seen the play, but I read in the play that there is interaction between the actors and the audience.
In some venues. I wrote, this is interesting, there's one place, there's a breakout scene where the actors as actors argue about having maids, about having house cleaning.
I know Barbara Ehrenreich says no one should have maids.
I know she does. And that was the one place where I, reading the book, no one should have maids, but some of us sometimes need cleaning help. Because we don't work in our houses like freelance writers. We work outside the home. You know, we're not home 12 hours a day. We have three kids. We have, yes, people get by. But I don't think it's a question of honor. For me, the question is not whether you have help cleaning your house, but how well you pay that person and how you treat them and how you regard them. So reading the book where Barbara says, I would never hire cleaning help. In fact, I find the whole idea repugnant, was the one place I went, wait a minute, aren't you sanctimonious? I needed help when I had three kids and was working 60 hours a week.
Did you inject this into the play too?
Yes, and because then I thought, if I have this reaction, then a whole lot of people are going to have this reaction. And I don't want them to be sitting there with that reaction, turning against the protagonist, you know, hating her for being sanctimonious and self-righteous. So I wrote this breakout where one of the actresses says, wait a minute, and they start accusing each other. They know, and this was realistic at a big theater, you know, the actresses could have cleaning help. And they argue about this and about, and some of them have been cleaning help, which is very normal for actors. So they argue about this with the audience, and they finally turn it to the audience, and it actually pops the bubble, and you know, in a very good way for an affluent audience that has cleaning help. But it's irrelevant when the play is at a smaller, poorer theater where the actors couldn't possibly have cleaning help, or as is happening now, it's being done at a college, you know. We don't do that. I tell them not to do that scene, unless the audience is going to have that reaction. But I make them cut that line.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the host of Progressive Radio and editor of the Progressive Magazine. With me today is Joan Holden, award-winning playwright who has adapted Barbara Ehrenreich's best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, for the stage. Now, you, for three decades, worked with the San Francisco Mime Troupe. You're no longer with them?
I left in 2000 after 30 years in a collective.
Is that why you left?
Pretty much, actually.
Well, tell me a little bit about that.
And it becomes difficult that collectives are usually founded by peers. You know, that's in a burst of enthusiasm. And in, and they are absolutely organic, the way to do, to get the work done, the way to do the thing that you're doing. It becomes, the mime troupe became what was called in the theater world, institutionalized, you know, inevitably in the 70s and 80s, in order to survive, had to become a business. And people left, and you know, people came and people went. The first generation of the collective left, and then it becomes more and more difficult for there comes a kind of generational conflict in something as intense as I don't know what it's like at a radio station or a magazine, but a theater is something that consumes your every moment. It's a 12-hour a day, 7-day a week, living together, working together, being obsessed together, and there's a kind of generation conflict that seems almost inevitable. When I've been here 20 years and you just got here last week and we're supposed to have an equal voice, that it's, or, you know, that's from the older person's point of view, and from the younger person's point of view, just because you've been here, you think you have the right to call all the shots.
So the resentments flow both ways.
Definitely. Definitely, and they're inevitable, and they're organic, and they're part of change. So it, at a certain point, it became time for me to leave, and I left.
The San Francisco Mime Troupe used to travel around. I haven't seen it traveling around. Why is that?
Because there's no money for touring. And it's interesting to talk about where that money came from. In the 60s, in the late 60s, when I joined the troupe, it came from campus student governments, from university student governments, which were all controlled by SDS. So political and especially anti-war plays could travel the country.
Funded along the way,
and draw large enthusiastic audiences and lead demonstrations against the war and it was possible. This is always on a shoestring, but the shoestring was there. In the 70s, those campus activists went off campus and formed all kinds of community organizations like WART. And those community organizations were able to bring the troupe for about half of the 70s until the price of oil went way up. Then it got hard until the National Endowment for the Arts stepped in. And ironically, the best period of the National Endowment from my point of view as an artist was the Reagan years.
There's an irony. Why is that? We only have a couple seconds, but why is that?
Because of a lag. The people who'd been the visionaries, that generation of administration at the National Endowment had a very comprehensive vision. There should be art of every kind for everybody. And it funded things on every level, from symphony orchestras to, you know, political theater companies. And there was touring money. So when touring became too expensive for community organizations to afford, the National Endowment was there with a touring subsidy.
But I take it that's dried up now.
That's all gone.
Well, that's the way things are in this Republican era. Joan Holden, playwright, adapter of Nickel and Dime, thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you.
You can find more about this at nickelanddime.net.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.